plaster is taken from his eyebrow. And with that moisture, the wiping of the head and the feet is carried out, you know. So I think this is an answer to a question that you asked earlier when we were discussing this issue, that in the event that one does not have an arm to wipe the feet, so someone else can do it. Someone else can take the water from his beard or from his eyebrows and pull over his feet. Because he doesn't have four arms, so he can do it, and someone else can do it.
I see. Okay. You know, Sheikh Tawid, most of the time you would find a kind of public convenience affiliated or built close by, I mean, near the mosques.
Yes.
All right? And near the place where sometimes the Friday prayer is performed, there's also that kind of a place which is affiliated and specified for people or the mosque goers to make wudu in them for themselves, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the water, you know, bill is not even paid for by the budget of the mosque, all right? Is
yes.
it permissible for those individuals who go to the mosque, the same mosque, to perform the Friday prayer, to use the same water for the wudu?
Well, His Eminence, in an answer given to this question, he has said that as the water is prepared for performing wudu, for all those who perform prayers in that place or in that Jami Masjid or Central Mosque, of course, now without any restrictions, you know, there's no restriction as to who should do it, who shouldn't do it. Of course, the water is there for all mu'mineen to use.
Yes.
So there's no problem in using that water to make wudu, and therefore there wouldn't be any problem with regard to the wudu and the prayers they perform.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawid, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem La ilaha illa hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir La ilaha illa hum Rahim محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Every night and every day Every night and every day Never forget to say La ilaha illallah Never forget to say La ilaha illallah
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Mu'allim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Kalev Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding, prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Home, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha and the Shia mutakallimin of the 8th century Hijra, the author of more than 120 books. He is no one but Hassan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar Hilli, mainly known as Allama Hilli. Allama means polymath. His books are really welcomed by most of the scholars and Shiite scholars, and his role in spreading Shia Islam, especially in old Persia, is really outstanding. We'll talk more about this aspect of his life, but let's be more familiar with the early life of Allama Hilli from your tongue. The person who is believed for the first time in the history has been titled as Ayatullah. Okay, Allama Hilli. Okay, who is Allama Hilli, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allama Hilli was born in 648 Hijri Qamari in Hilla. And Hilla is a place between the Karbala and Najaf. Mm-hmm. And obviously, he was amongst the, we can say, mutakallimin, the theologian, the Shia theologian. He was a scholar of the Ilm al-Usul. Obviously, before him, the Akhbariyun were very much famous, but he got famous because of the Usul, following the path of Usuliyun. And obviously, he was a great scholar in the jurisprudence and the logic and philosophy, because he got all those things. And he reached to the level of Ijtihad, why he was known as Ayatullah as well.
Yes.
And because of him having the knowledge of multiple, we can say, sciences, he was known as the sign of Allah. Mm-hmm. That a person, you know, because the word, even when we say Allame for yes. the Hilli, Allame is the one who has command over the different sciences.
A polymath. Yes.
So basically, that's why the word Allama is used mm-hmm. with him.
Okay.
And due to this reason, at that time, they used to call him the sign of Allah, that obviously in praise of him, that we haven't seen such a person who is fallible and he has reached to this level. So that's why he was also known as the Ayatullah. On the other hand, we can see like Allama Baqir Majlisi and Sheikh Bahai, they had the permission from the students of Allama Hilli, where it was written that he was Ayatullah fil Alameen.
Mm-hmm.
He is the sign of Allah in the worlds.
Okay.
So it shows the rank and the status of this personality, that how big he was and the status that he had. So basically, he has learned the Quran from his father and the other things from his father and his mother's brother. We say like uncle.
That's right.
Because we have specific word in Persian and Urdu, mm-hmm. Even in the Arabic, for the mother's brother. But when we say in English, it's just uncle, it's uncle.
Yes.
It can be the father's okay. brother or the mother's.
Yes.
So it was basically Muhaqqiq Hilli. We have two Hillis.
Like, yeah, Muhaqqiq Hilli was his master.
His master, and yes. he was his mother's brother, yes. his uncle, basically.
And after the demise of Muhaqqiq Hilli, most of the students refer yes. to Allama Hilli now.
Yes.
And you know, he was 28 years old.
Yes.
At the very young age, he reached somehow the status of Marja'iyatul Am of Shia in the Hilla on that time, one of the most
And that was even
centers.
Because he was at yes. that rank before that.
Okay.
You know, he was at that point before that, because in some traditions or the historians or scholars, they have mentioned that he became the mm-hmm. the mushtahid, or he reached to that rank at the age of 13 or 14.
Yes.
But because Muhaqqiq Hilli was there.
Yes.
The students were not going towards this young kid.
And they
purposefully has hide this kid from the okay. general public
yes.
and didn't show.
Okay.
But after Muhaqqiq Hilli, since his age yes. was too young, like 28, 29, mm-hmm. so he got famous after him.
Sheikh Rouhani, the exact date of his entrance to Persia is not known, but his role in spreading the Shia Islam in Iran is really famous. What was the exact story?
Yes, there are many famous stories regarding this Allama al-Hilli, rahmatullahi alayh. So one of them, as you rightly mentioned, his entrance to Iran, to Persia at that time, is this that at that time, Sultan, the King Muhammad Khudabanda, one of the Mongols king and Salatin in Iran, of course, he was ruling over this area, and he was Sunni. Of course, the Sunni scholars were at that time in his castle with him as the consuls, as the advisors. And of course, when he came to Iran, he had lots of debates, discussion with these Sunni scholars. As a result of these debates with the Sunni scholars, which some of them were in the presence of the king, he actually proved the truthfulness of the Tashayyu, yes, Madhab al-Shia, in front, in the presence of the king, mm-hmm, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande. Okay. In one of those meetings that was held in the presence of the king, with the presence of many scholars, the Sunni scholars, he proved the truthfulness of this madhab, I mean Tashayyu, and then as a result of this debate, the king, Sultan Muhammad Khudabande, converted to Tashayyu.
What's his name? Sultan Muhammad Khudabande.
Sultan Muhammad Khudabande.
From beginning, was his name, original name, this, or no, then it was changed?
It was changed because he was Mongol, one of the Mongol kings.
The Ilkhanids.
Ilkhanites, okay. Yes. Okay. And of course, it was this Allama al-Hilli, rahmatullah alayhi, has a very great book on Imam Ali's truthfulness of Khilafah and Imamah, okay, which is called Minhaj al-Karama. Uh-huh. If you read Minhaj al-Karama, in that book, Allama al-Hilli proved the authenticity or the, let's say, truthfulness of his imamate based on Quran, ayat and riwayat, and hadith, the traditions and history, and finally the aql. Mm-hmm. It is a very good book. It is a very nice book, which later was criticized by Ibn Taymiyyah.
That's right.
Ibn Taymiyyah criticized that book, and this mazhab of Wahhabi based on that doctrines established by him, opposing to this main and very outstanding work of Allama al-Hilli. There are two more very nice stories about Allama al-Hilli I wanted to mention.
Yes.
This is that according to, based on these narrations or these stories,
yes,
he actually visited or saw the Imam, the 12th Imam.
Imam al-Asr.
Imam al-Asr, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. It is said about him that once he borrowed a book from one of the Sunni scholars, and he had to copy that book in one single night.
Okay.
So he started to copy that book to write from the text, I mean himself by his own hand. But at the middle of the night, he got tired and he did not have any more energy to copy that. And then at the same time, he had to finish the book in one single night. So then he was actually confused what to do. Suddenly he saw a very young man, a beautiful young Sayyid came to him and asked him that, I can help you. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, tonight I cannot accept any guests because I have to finish
this book.
Yeah, please go.
Ascribing
yeah,
this
yeah,
book.
I okay. have to finish this. I cannot accept any guests tonight. He said, so I will help you. Okay. I can help you. He said that you are so young, it's difficult, this mm-hmm. text is difficult, and you have to write it very correctly, exactly, beautifully. And then it is said that he tested him. Mm-hmm. Allama al-Hilli tested, asked him any question and asked him to write. First, he wrote in a way, then he said, I can write better than this.
Okay.
Said, okay. Finally, he said that, okay, he might he can write better than me even.
Okay.
And then he left the book for him and said, okay, please copy it. I want to add a short nap.
Nap.
Yeah. And then when he woke up, Allama al-Hilli, when he woke up, he saw that, okay, the book was written completely till the end of the book.
Oh.
In the most authentic and perfect way. And then he understood that, okay, this young man was not a normal man. Because
right.
this book was a difficult book and it had lots of technical terms. It is a fiqh book, yes. for example. And how could he finish in one single night?
Mm-hmm.
I got tired just, for example, some pages I just I've just written. This is one of these stories that Allama al-Hilli says that it was the
okay.
only the 12th Imam can do this. Otherwise, the other people mm-hmm. cannot do it. And the other one is that in one of his journey to Karbala, he was just walking towards Karbala and he saw then a young man, mm-hmm. a very scholarly figure.
Okay.
And he started talking with him, asking many difficult questions from that young man. He answered mm-hmm. all of the questions that You know, when a scholar have questions, they're really difficult questions.
Yes.
And when he was asking him, he was answering all the questions. Then finally he asked this question that, young man, great scholar, respected scholar, is it possible to visit or to see the 12th Imam? Then, stick in his hand, Allama al-Hilli.
Yes.
It was suddenly fell down.
Mm-hmm.
And then that man, Imam al-Zaman, al-Faraji al-Sharif, give it back to Allama al-Hilli, mm-hmm. hand to hand.
Yes.
He said, why isn't it possible? Why the hand of the Imam is right now in your hand?
Oh.
And then, at this occasion, Imam Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif mentioned him a very important hadith,
mm-hmm.
in one of the Shiite sources. He said that you have to refer to that hadith,
mm-hmm.
and then this hukm that you are asking is mentioned in that hadith, of that book, for example. It was one of the book of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi, if I'm not mistaken, Tahzib,
yes.
I think.
Tahzib, okay.
And then later, when Allama al-Hilli referred to that book, find out the exact hadith, and in commentary on that hadith, he wrote that I was informed of this hadith by the 12th Imam.
Oh, it was written by...
Yeah, it was written by Allama al-Hilli himself, that Imam Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif mentioned this hadith, and I was informed of this hadith by the Imam. So this was really nice...
It shows the highest status of Allama al-Hilli.
Yeah, of course, al-Hilli. Rahmatullahi alayhi.
Okay, that's right. Very good.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
So what about his books, his compilations, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi?
According to himself, Allama Ali has said that he had 57
mm-hmm.
books that he has he wrote. And obviously the status that he had, obviously we can find some of the other scholars have mentioned that, for example, he had 95 books.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when Allama Ali has wrote about himself, it wasn't completed, the rest of them. So there are different things that were made by Allah or that were written by Allah Mahili. For example, Mukhtalif al-Shi'a, Tazkiratul Fuqaha. In the fiqh, we have Kashful Murad.
Mm-hmm.
We have Babi Hadi Ashar, Minhaj al-Karama. In the theology, we have, the book, which is Khulasatul Aqwal. And Jawharun Nazid, one of the... we can say magnificent books in logic. Generally we study logic, but the one who studies Jawharun Nazid, he goes to the next level, to extraordinary level.
Okay.
So basically these are the books which were written by Allama Hilli. And even in today's time, Kashful Murad has been taught in the Hawza. Kashful Murad is one of the books for the theology, in the theology.
Okay.
And generally in the Hawza, they teach it at the master level. They don't even teach it at the graduation level.
Oh, because at the primary level, no.
Not at the primary level, we can say like the graduation.
Graduation,
it should be in the master's level.
Advanced ones.
It's not under the graduate. Postgraduate, for example.
Yes, that's right.
Why? Because you have to learn a lot of things in order to understand this book.
Okay.
So we have Tazkiratul Fuqaha as the fiqhi, Mukhtalifat al-Shia as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest were in the theology, and Khulasatul Aqwal as the Ilm al-Rijal. These were the things which were written by Allama Hilli. And on top of that, it is better to mention about his teacher, because we have mentioned from whom he benefited.
Yes.
Sayyid ibn Taus is one of the teachers, Al-Muhaqqiq Hilli. It was Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And we have the name, Yahya bin Sa'id Hilli.
Yes.
And amongst his, students, we have Qutbuddin Razi. These are the famous names that generally people know. Otherwise, there are many students.
Yes.
But obviously, Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin.
Yes.
The son of Allama.
Okay.
Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin is the one who wrote the book of Ma'alim.
Yes.
Basically.
Okay.
And he was also one of the greatest scholars.
That's right.
So this is the basically overall introduction, we can say, like, of the Allama Hilli.
That's all right. This outstanding man passed away on Muharram 21st, 726, according to the Hijra calendar, at the age of 78. Becomes in the city of Hilla, because after the demise of Sultan Muhammad Khudabandi, he migrates again back to Hilla and resides over there up until the end of his life. And his body was taken into the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam in the city of Najaf, and he is buried over there today, the visiting place of so many Muslims and Shia Muslims all across the world. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
For a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Hasan ibn Yusuf ibn Mutahhar al-Hilli, mainly known as Allama al-Hilli. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information on this program and other episodes, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Democracy in History, Part 4.
Persia had survived the destructions wreaked by the Macedonians and was under the rule of the Sassanid Empire. They too used religion as an ideological factor against their enemies. Unlike what we see during the Achaemenid rule, a religious government ruled in the Sassanid period. Sassanid Persia had a central government with a state religion.
هخامنشیان تو دوره انتقال مذهبی بودن یعنی ما اون دوره تازه داشتیم.
The Achaemenid period was the time of religious transit. The Mazdean religion was just beginning to take shape. The Mithraism, there were still remnants of older religions. The fact that no religion had become dominant had created a more open setting. But as the Sassanid came to power, they could create a powerful and somehow oppressive system that at the end of the day led to the conversion of the Iranians.
In Sassanid Persia, Zoroastrianism was compulsory all over Iran as the state religion. The conflict between the two great empires of that time had turned religious.
The Sassanid rulers were lucky because a priest called Nestorius was called an atheist by an Orthodox church in Byzantium. And he found refuge in Persia. And the Persian Christians started to follow him and fight against Rome. Though they were not killed anymore, because they believed that Rome was their enemy, they considered Byzantium their enemy. These intense wars began to weaken the Persian society, and some of the thinkers and the intellectuals of that time started to look for a solution. They were divided into two groups. The members of one group, like Mazdak and Mani, sought religious reforms, and the members of the second group sought a new prophet, like Salman. Salman finds Prophet Muhammad in Medina and becomes one of his followers.
It was no longer the ruling priorities and conflict of interests that turned Persia and Rome against each other. Christianity was put against Zoroastrianism, and a new era in the history of the world had started. Orientalists call this period the era of Eastern dictatorship, but that's a Western point of view. What history has remembered about that period is the skin of democracy in the West and dictatorship in the East. This is a part of a Western religious historiography that disqualifies anything that is pitted against Christianity. What is called Eastern dictatorship in Western texts is in fact the religious conflict between the Persian and Roman empires.
Ignoring the rights of the Easterners was something that existed in the West and Europe since long time ago. You can see in Greek works that many Greek authors do not mention many important parts of history or presented a distorted version of it.
This is a constant phenomenon in Europe, and you can see some traces of it during the Crusades. You can also see its traces before the time of the Roman Empire. It continues during the colonizing activities in the 17th and 18th centuries, and its peak in the 19th century. It turns into an official ideology in Europe so that they can occupy and plunder different countries and to practice slavery. One of the things that justify slavery is this backward attitude of the native people of other countries. Easterners have always had a dictator ruling them. They never had democracy. Power was always centralized. Their king was always a dictator.
The most important concept of democracy is the freedom of human beings, equal rights for humans to decide their own destiny in social, economic, cultural, and political affairs. We can find such a thing in ancient Persia, but we can see that in ancient Greece, which was the main claimant to such a concept.
Even when you look at Rome and Greece, the problem of power, slavery, social advantages, slave exploitation, arrogance, and dictatorship was more prominent in the West rather than the East.
There were almost no cases of deposition in Rome. Their rival organization, the Senate, which doesn't do much and is suppressed. There was just one incident at the very beginning, when there was no empire yet, when the Tsar was killed. Otherwise, it didn't do much. The emperors that were supposed to be deposed were killed, almost always by their own guards. I mean, there were no organizations to support and protect them. The kings died by conspiracies. In Persia, kings were deposed when they misbehaved or suffered a defeat in a war or were not very successful.
The story of Julius Caesar and his conflict with the Senate and Caesar's murder and the transfer of power to his deputies, which has been turned into a play, could not have been far from the truth.
Greece's democracy established the pillars of a kind of government in which people ruled people without divine approval. The main criterion for Athens' democracy was cutting people's relationship to the gods, rather than considering people's wishes. But Persia had a government connected to the heavens both in the Achaemenid and Sassanid periods. Kings needed the gods' approval in order to be able to rule over people. They also had to be fair so that people did not leave them. They had to build an army to protect their divine approving government against invaders. The Romans are considered the first Christian rulers. But they were in fact opportunistic rulers that used religious ideology to unite different nations in their empire against Persia. They were the first religious empires in the world. All these methods set the theoretical pillars of democracy in future.
Some thinkers like Plato and Aristotle, who had a different opinion,
believe that systems such as democracy, dictatorship, the role of aristocrats, the role of capitalists, etc., were not self-sufficient and automatically cultivated their opposing systems inside themselves. It means this kind of democracy is ephemeral. It lasts for some time and then breeds another system inside itself.
Even in the newer period, in spite of the fact that people were supposedly involved in choosing their government, this public opinion is always inclined in favor of rich and powerful people, and it's power and wealth that defines public votes.
If we are supposed to give the reins of governance to a great number of people, by what criteria can these people choose the right way of thinking? The right way of thinking can be known by only one person. A person who is wise and intelligent. He's the one who can lead a society with his knowledge. A group of people have no criteria that can lead us to the truth. A government is supposed to prompt us into being a good society, to make us healthy and prosperous.
Can we really say that this system in the 5th century BC, known as the Greek democracy, was really a democracy?
Well, what can be the signs of democracy? Everyone having their own way of thinking or constantly living with the fear of losing his life, wealth, and other belongings.
In the Behistun inscription and Naqsh-e Rostam, Darius tells his children, if you want to live in peace in your country, keep an eye on the Persian people. By keeping an eye on people, he meant supporting and taking care of them.
Democracy underwent many ups and downs after that, and was interpreted in different ways. Even at certain points in time, it adopted the opposite of its original meaning. These changes were part of the concept of democracy since the beginning, since its Athenian days. At the time when Socrates gathered young people in the Athens Bazaar and encouraged them to doubt their gods, values, and themselves. But the Athenian democracy could not tolerate any doubts in its principles and sentenced Socrates to death. If democracy had let Socrates' voice be heard at that time, perhaps we would have a different world today. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. I am with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, dear listeners, as we know, to know about Imam of our time, it's really important to know about the Imam himself, and it's also important to know about his friends and foes. And some of his friends and foes have been discussed in the signs. Yes, we had been talking about the signs of reappearance, and right now we had been talking about a person named Sufyani who will rise before the reappearance of Imam. Well, Dr. Karimi, what are the goals of Sufyani, knowing about his time and place of uprising? What is his goal? What does he want?
So first of all, we are talking about a very wicked person. Such people, usually, they are looking for more power, for more dominance over different countries. And we can understand from the narrations that there are two main goals for the uprising of Sufyani. The first one is killing the Shia, and there is no doubt about that. For example, there is one narration in this regard from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. This is an authentic narration in Al-Ghiba by Sheikh Nu'mani, chapter 18, page 311, hadith number 3. The Imam talks about two features of Sufyani, one of them being his anger and second being his hatred. Imam says that his anger and his hatred are only toward the Shia. And of course, Imam said that Shi'atana, our Shia. There is no doubt about the fact that one of the main reasons for all these merciless actions and violent actions of Sufyani in different countries, including the Shia countries, is to just to massacre the Shia. There are different scenarios why, Sufyani is looking for killing the Shia. In one of the previous episodes, we talked about the religion of Sufyani, whether he is Muslim or Christian or a Muslim converting to Christianity. So I'm not going to repeat that. It seems that there might be two motivations for him trying to kill and massacre the Shia. The first opinion might be that, like many Wahhabis nowadays that consider Shia as a heretic denomination, as a disbeliever, he may have the same viewpoints. We know that when it comes to ISIS, for example, they consider Shia as kuffar, as disbelievers, and that is why they were looking for massacring the Shia. This is the viewpoint of, unfortunately, such extremists among Muslims, if of course we may consider them as Muslims. So it is at least one of the possibilities that Sufyani holds the same viewpoint regarding the Shia. In his eyes too, Shia are a group of deviated Muslims, or rather disbelievers. They have brought innovations, bid'ahs in the religion, and they should be killed. This is one viewpoint. The other viewpoint is that, no, it might be that the Shi'i thought is one of the main obstacles against the benefits of the superpowers in the world. As we see nowadays, that the Shi'i thought, as it is preached by Islamic Republic of Iran, and alhamdulillah, it is spreading in many countries, it is against the benefits of some of the superpowers.
True.
So it might be said that maybe Sufyani is provoked by some of the superpowers. And of course, we had the same regarding ISIS as well. At least some of the leaders of ISIS were provoked by some of the superpowers of the world.
Yes, we'll discuss more about this topic after a short break. So, dear listeners, stay tuned for more interesting data about the certain sign of reappearance that Sufyani. Because knowing about foes of Imam is equally important as we want to know about the Imam. Welcome back to The Last Savior. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am with Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the goal of Sufyani, who is one of the certain signs of reappearance. What could be motivating him to kill Shias?
Regarding the second possibility, that Sufyani is against the Shia because of the fact that some of the superpowers in the world, they will provoke him. It might not be a clear narration confirming that, but at least there is one narration which may confirm this theory. This narration is morsal, which means that it doesn't have the chain of the narration.
Okay.
And it means that it's not an authentic narration. But let me discuss about the content of the narration, which may give us at least
kind
a hint
of idea.
Regarding kind of the analysis of the uprising of Sufyani. In this narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, Sufyani, to fight the rulership of Khorasani, who is ruling over Iran, according to this narration,
okay,
he will go to Rome. And of course, Rome in such narration is referring to the Western countries.
All right.
To repel this Khorasani, he goes to Rome for attracting and gaining the help of such countries. And of course, the narration continues to say that when he comes from there, he comes back as a Christian, like as he is carrying a cross around his neck.
Okay.
So if we accept this narration, we may agree that, Sufyani somehow is helped and supported and provoked by some of the Western
powers
countries,
some
of the superpowers. And of course, the other main and goal of Sufyani is for sure to prevent from the worldwide uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his
reappearance.
And we know that later we'll discuss about the course of the events. Finally, they will fight each other, the army of Sufyani and the army of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. A part of the army of Sufyani will be swallowed up in a region called Baida, and we have the concept of Khasf Baida as one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And this Sufyani himself will be killed either by the Imam himself or one of the people in the army of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
We'll be back in a short break.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is IRIV English Radio. I'm Zainab with Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the certain signs of reappearance. One of them is the uprising of Sufyani, and we were talking about his goals, how he is going to stand against Imam. Can you give us some details?
We are talking about him coming from Sham, a region from Sham, either in today's Syria or Palestine and Jordan. But now the question is that because of the fact that he's in need of a great army.
Yes.
When we are talking about the fact that he's coming from Sham, now the question is that, is he going to gain power in Sham through a coup? Or no, for example, he will be elected as a leader like what we have today, the elections, based on the laws of that country, Sham. There are at least some evidence, some indications in the narrations that give us this conclusion that he is going to gain power through a coup, not through, kind of election or anything like that. There are some narrations which confirm that. And first of all, there are some narrations according to which Sufyani will fight other people who also try to gain power, and Sufyani will defeat them through the fighting, not
okay.
through the elections. There are some narrations. Those who are interested can refer to Mu'jam Ahadith Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, volume 3, page 275. There is one authentic narration in this regard from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, according to which the Imam says, The first land which will be destroyed out of these fightings is Sham. Three flags will fight each other in Sham, meaning that three people are looking for power. And of course, all of them are against the Shia. None of them is with the truth. So one of them is the flag of a person called Ashab. The second is that of a person called Al-Abqa. And the third one is that of Sufyani. First of all, there is a fight between Sufyani and Abqa. They will fight each other. But Sufyani will kill him and his army. Then he will kill the third person, that is Ashab. So at least this narration can give us this conclusion that Sufyani is not going to gain power through a democratic way, through an election. No. So this is one narration, and this narration is quoted in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, chapter 14, page 288, hadith number 67. The second narration, which also shows that Sufyani gains power through a coup, is the narration referring to his hidden life.
Okay.
Sufyani will lead a very secret life. So for sure, if he is going to gain power through a democratic way, he's not in need of such a life, in a secret way. Of course, before gaining the power. There is one narration according to which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَقَدْ بَلَغَ مِنْ خُبْتِهِ أَنَّهُ يَدْفُنُ أُمَّ وَلَدِ اللَّهِ وَهِيَ حَيَّ. Sufyani is so wicked that he will kill one of his wives, أُمَّ وَلَدْ, who is the mother of one of his children.
Okay.
وَهِيَ حَيَّ, while she is still, alive. Why? مَخَافَةَ أَن تَدُلَّ لَهُ. Because Sufyani is afraid that she may tell the people where he is hiding.
Okay.
And so this narration, first of all, is telling us how wicked is he.
How cruel he is.
Exactly. To the extent that he is ready to kill his wife.
He burns a woman alive.
Because he's afraid that she may tell the people about the place that he is hiding. And second of all, another indication that he will gain power through a coup and not through a democratic way. This is in Kamaluddin, chapter 57, hadith number 10. And the last narration in this regard is the narration which talk about a chaotic situation at that time in Syria, in Sham.
Okay.
And of course, under such chaotic situation, we cannot expect any kind of election through which Sufyani is elected. For example, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is quoted as saying, addressing Jabir, that at that time, in that year, Fatil Kastana, فيها اختلاف كثير في كل أرض من ناحية المغرب. In the West, including Sham and Syria, there would be much differences among the people, chaotic situation. So all these three narrations at least indicate that Sufyani will gain power through a coup.
What we have concluded so far is that Sufyani is going to be in a warlike situation. He's not gaining power through any democracy, through any kind of votes. He's having war, and we have talked about his wickedness, how cruel he is. So we talked about his cruelness, and may Allah's curse be on all the foes of Imam. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Brother Muzaffar. Both of you, welcome to Back to Reality.
Assalamualaikum. My pleasure to be here.
Of course, the pleasure is all in here. Brother Muzaffar, shall we start with you? Please introduce yourself briefly, very much, what you study and...
I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've studied English literature and now I'm in the Hawza, in the Islamic Seminary.
That's very good. It's a pleasure to have you in here and wish you luck with your studies. You, Sister Bita.
Yes, I'm at your service. I'm Bita and I study medicine at one of the University of Tehran in Iran.
So there's this issue that happens in many places. When you go to a special office, you might see all the people wearing the same thing, like what happens in the hospitals. They all are dressing the same way. And I always wonder, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing?
I think it's absolutely despicable. It is ruining the individuality of the society. Every person is being forced and compelled to fit into a certain box. Everybody's being given a label.
You know, we need it. I think this is necessary for every part of the society. We have to, I don't know, design some rules, some special things, some, I don't know, lines here. And one of them is dress code. We have to have dress code here because, you know, it may look like discipline here, you know, when most of the people wear uniforms, they are equal to each other and they don't actually pay attention to the appearance of the people.
So what this is the point. What we do that if, for peace. What if I don't like to be like others?
So you shouldn't go to a place where it doesn't have dress code. You can change your workplace. You know what?
Oh, really? So what if I have the potential to be a perfect person in there, in that job?
So this is your problem. You know, this is the rule of that of there. You'll have to accept it.
Hang on a second. You're saying that this Einstein, she wants to be a doctor, yeah? But she's not allowed to just because she won't wear a blue overcoat? Or the, one of those
answer that.
She can cure cancer, but no, because you don't wear a stethoscope around your neck.
If that goal is that much important, so wearing a blue coat is not that much a pain in the neck.
There you go. You just said it yourself. Useless. We don't need a dress code. We don't need uniform.
We do need it.
Why do we need it?
Can you go with, I don't know, t-shirts to the, I don't know, a kind of...
No, not t-shirt. But for example, I want to work at...
So it means dress code again. You know what? I think the definition of dress code is somehow wrong in our brains. Dress code is a kind of way of being, not for example, the color. I mean, uniforms and dress code are two different separated things.
Oh, how?
You know, uniforms make all the people equal to each other. They are the same.
All the people of the same place.
The same color, the same design, the same...
So what is dress code?
Dress code is different. Dress code means that there are some special lines. For example,
kind of social
you have to wear cheddar. It doesn't matter what color is your cheddar.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the difference between dress code and uniform.
So, but in order just to digest the difference between dress code and uniforms, let's go for a change of mood and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So it's dress code, and I didn't know there's a difference between these dress codes that we're talking about.
My own mindset.
No, that's true. It's pretty logical.
For example, when you do a party, you tell them, is it casual wear or is it formal wear?
Exactly. This is again dress code.
Yeah, so then from casual. I'm sick of seeing the news, and every single news anchor, male news anchor, is wearing a suit. I'm so bored of seeing it. Why can't they come on the news dressed like a cowboy or like a Jedi Knight outfit? Or,
you know, yeah,
why
yeah,
not? I would still
well.
Trust him as much.
This is your mindset.
Right? Why does he have to wear that, though? I don't get it.
I would like difference as well, you know? There must be a difference in every single person.
Yeah, think about it.
We're supposed to
trust the news, right? So yeah. They have to wear formal clothing. So you get all these men anchors.
So
female anchors.
Does it have anything to do with being plausible? I mean, that uniform has got to do something with the audience believing him or
her. Yeah, exactly. It makes you more trustworthy. More, I'm professional.
Really?
Of course. Yeah, if I was wearing a suit right now, these guys would probably like give me a management position here.
Oh, you know? I never looked at it from this perspective.
Yeah, of course. But then, okay, I'd like to point out that the worst of villains and criminals and liars and despots in this world today wear exactly that clothing.
Oh, yeah.
So why are we still trusting it? Why can't news anchors just change their clothes?
Conscience.
Why can't they come on there wearing, I don't know,
No, it's anything. Just because it's formal. It's the formal way of dressing.
Yeah.
That's it. It's not just to make the audience believe them or whatever. It's just about something being the formal way of dressing.
Who decided it's formal? I want to go dressed as a Viking.
It's a background thing. You know, you cannot change.
Then who drew the borders in
the
countries? Why do we have borders?
Ah, now you're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
It's all about the colonial control thing.
So it's the same thing about that.
So the same thing.
Yeah, you know, there are some
I don't believe in borders.
I don't believe in borders as well.
We don't believe in
it. It's all Earth.
It's easy to say, but yeah, I mean, Allah created it as a sphere for a reason, right?
But, you know, you're going too extreme in that. Even I believe in uniforms here. And I think we need uniforms because...
Uniforms are disgusting.
Out of school.
How
we
could
need
you
them.
Say that?
We need them. For
this
example,
is the same
imagine
sister
a school.
Who was an utter dictator when she took control of the world.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Now you're an open book to us right now.
Oh, my gosh.
No, sorry, go on.
Yeah. The thing I'm going to tell you is that we need that because sometimes, for example, even especially in young generation, they pay attention a lot about appearance.
That's true, yeah.
So, because for reducing this pain, a lot of attention to appearance, we have to consider some dress code and some uniforms here.
Because it gets rid of poverty. There's some kids who can't afford
rich
clothes, and then there's some kids.
So, before we get into the core of what you're talking about, let's go for a change of mood, and then we'll be back. So we were talking about uniforms and the so-called dress code and the things like this. And actually, you mentioned a lot of nice stuff. I didn't know that the news speakers are just using those formal dresses to make people believe whatever they say.
Yeah, not just news speakers, but, you know,
so the formal dresses are just for that way.
It's a total psychological game that everybody is playing, you know.
Yeah. So nice. Now, what happens in society if we all are dressed in the same way? And when I say in the very same way, I don't mean that they all dress like the same colors and the same stuff. I just say have a dress code. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got you.
Like you should wear, for example, as women, you should wear chadors.
So easier like that. It's so, yeah, I mean, we're not talking about something imaginary.
Yeah.
It is a reality that we are facing in some countries.
I know. Are you for it or against it? Do you think it must be like this or no? Everybody should go for whatever they like.
No, I think it depends on the place you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to the street, yeah, there should be some lines.
Some restrictions.
Yeah, some restrictions, but not to the that extreme way to, I don't know, tell you to wear these and wear that and wear those and so on. And it's not like that in any country. I think there is no country in the world that will be like, okay, everyone is the same, as you told me. It's not like that. We are free.
I guess all the countries have got their dress codes, their own dress codes, right?
But for some special places.
For example, in all of the countries, you cannot go to university with whatever dress you want to wear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can't be so easy.
Mm.
And we need it.
No, I totally disagree. You see, what you have just done is restricted a person's mode of expression, one of the most important modes of expression that we have, which is through the clothing that we wear.
Are not actually limiting the completely from the root at all. You have an area you can choose in that
exactly.
area. You know, this
see,
is the point.
Let me tell you something. Like, for example,